And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on podcastufo.com. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And with me coming up in just a minute is Alejandro Rojas with the UFO updates. Our guest this evening is David Paris, and he's going to be talking to us about warp drive again. He was on a couple years ago. He's going to be back because there have been some new breakthroughs, so stay tuned for that. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. It's an easy thing to do. You just sign up at podcastufo.com for $2 or more per month, and you get to listen to the full entire shows plus all the archives. And that's it for me. Alejandro, how are you?
Hello, I am well.
Well, I'm glad you are well, sir.
It was good. Then before the show, we started talking, and you were getting me depressed, so it was sucky.
Yeah, I know.
But I'm back to well, so I'm recovering.
Yeah, we can all just laugh and move on, right?
Yeah.
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 Sorry about that, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, is there anything going on in the UFO world?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I want to ask you something first. Have you seen Arrival?
No.
The movie?
No.
Neither have I. But, man, people who have seen it love it. And there's just – I'm getting the most incredible reviews. One person told me yesterday who is, that it was like their favorite sci-fi movie ever.
Wow.
I know. Very high praise. So I just wanted to mention that and see what your feedback was. But, yeah, people are loving it. So I think that's news because it's causing all of these stories. And if you go into, you know, we post headlines every day. If you go look at our headlines, there's several stories, you know, where people are talking about if aliens come, how are we going to talk to them? Do we have a protocol? Blah, blah, blah. So it's generating a lot of buzz around this topic. So that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, so if the person listening is not familiar with it, I'll just read you the quick little synopsis. Linguistics professor
you
Luis.
You just happened to have that available.
Well, I Googled it while we were talking.
That's quick work.
I know. Linguistics professor Louise Banks, Amy Adams, leads an elite team of investigators when gigantic spaceships touch down in 12 locations around the world. As nations teeter on the verge of global war, Banks and her crew must race against time to find a way to communicate with the extraterrestrial visitors. Hoping to unravel the mystery, she takes a chance that could threaten her life and quite possibly all of mankind. Check it out in a theater near you. Mm-hmm. And it's got a 93% of Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty doggone high.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and, you know, a spoiler alert, but essentially, I guess she brings her chihuahua with her, and the chihuahua starts barking, and she's like, shut up, but then she realizes the chihuahua is communicating with the aliens, and the chihuahua saves the planet.
Wow. I have to watch that now.
Actually, I made that part up, but that would be a good movie.
Oh, wow. Wow. Now, you really got me disappointed.
Sounds like I blew your mind there.
You did for a minute, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So other UFO news, should we talk about that?
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
Okay, some real news. Well, kind of. This first story is just kind of a cute one that we got from MUFON, I think. It's like the chihuahua of aliens. So essentially, this girl said she was chatting with a friend, And she took a screenshot, and in the background, there's like this little kind of alien-looking thing she felt. So she sent that in, and she said they have seen some UFOs around there recently. Now, The MUFON Washington Assistant State Director, this was in Washington, this was June 17th of 2016, Doesn't feel like it's probably an alien. They said it's probably one of those cases of pareidolia, which is, as they explain it, a psychological phenomena where the mind perceives a familiar pattern where none actually exists. Mm. And I think they're probably right, because it is a poor screen grab. You know, it's low resolution and stuff like that. And they're probably right about that. But it does almost look like, you know, some cute little alien standing back there. So it's kind of a fun one. And I know, because when I posted this, you know, a lot of people will go, oh, that's not really an alien. And it's like, okay, I know. Read the story and you'll see that that was what was determined. But yeah, kind of a cute little story.
Yeah, one of the things, the human brain, and this is all has to do with evolution. It has to do with the fight or flight response, and that is the brain will take things that it sees and try to – a lot of times people will see a face in something, mm-hmm. you know, like a pattern on a wall or a smudge on a mirror or something. It'll look like a face, and that all has to do with evolution. It's really interesting if you look that up, and it has to do with survival, basically.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so your brain will just tend to take an image like she obviously must have. I'm not familiar with this. And then she sees an alien, which I think is, you know, kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think when people see the picture, they'll kind of see the alien too. They'll see what she's talking about. There may be some people who will disagree and say, no, that is an alien. You know, there's all types out there, and it takes all types, apparently. But it's kind of fun.
Yeah. So what else is happening?
What else is happening out there? So you noted that this story, for anybody who looked at it earlier, was a little screwed up, but it's all fixed now. It got mixed up with this Tucson story. I don't know what the heck I did. I screwed it up, but it's all fixed. If you saw an earlier version, but we hadn't talked about this on your show, and that is this video taken from North Carolina of a by a drone of what appears to be something odd. Now, it was taken by a 59-year-old man who is a retired Air Force. He had a 20-year military career. He shot the footage on October 26th at about 2 p.m., and there's just this little white object that goes very quickly shooting by. I mean, his drone was shooting 4K video, and he went back and he looked at it frame by frame, and he can't figure out what it is. He thought it was kind of strange. Now, people have noted who are familiar with drones that this sort of thing happens often, that when bugs or things fly by, that they can look really weird, and they say this happens quite a bit. And we've actually seen that sort of thing in other drone photographs or videos. So some are saying that it's probably just a bug that is reflecting the sun. But this retired Air Force guy feels that it's strange enough to submit it to MUFON. So you've looked at that video. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, at first I was trying to figure it out whether it was I thought it was small, whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. Relative to the distance between the ground and the drone. It does look kind of small. Maybe I was thinking like the size of a bird or a little bit bigger, but, you know, you just can't tell how far away it was. So, and it did move steady and fast, very fast.
Yeah.
But, again, you know, without knowing how far away it was from the drone, from the camera itself, it's awful hard to determine.
But, yeah. In fact, in our headlines, actually, this isn't a story we've written about because I'm not sure if there's enough there to write about it. But if you look in our headlines over Lake Ontario, there was a small passenger craft that I guess a couple people got injured. It's a Huffington Post story when they evaded a UFO. And the reason this reminds me of it is it's, first of all, recent. And they were suspecting that perhaps it was a drone of some sort that they had to avoid, or a balloon or something like that. So the title of the UFO is that two were injured after they had to evade a UFO, quote unquote. So I'm sure, you know, that the tabloids are going to run with that. And people will see that. But, yeah, they don't suspect it was necessarily some foreign technology or anything like that. They think it was something mundane. But some people debated, can drones fly that high? And I guess they can.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. The British tabloids will be having that as an underground base below it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
UFOs living under Lake Ontario.
Yes, absolutely. Hmm.
One last one that kind of has a cool drawing from The Witness is a case that was also submitted by Roger Marsh from MUFON. This took place on August 8th at about 7:30 a.m. when this guy says he saw a triangle shape hovering over the highway. That's crazy, huh? Mm-hmm. This was in Arkansas in Bella Vista. And he said it appeared about the size of an F-11 aardvark.
Hmm.
Aardvark is a weird name to call an aircraft because it would be oddly shaped. And aardvark don't fly.
Not yet, no.
Neither do warthogs, though, I guess, either.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what an aardvark is. But anyways, he said it was this semi-transparent large triangle craft and that it created a shadow on the ground. That's what he noticed first, was this big shadow on the ground. He's like, what the hell's that? He looks up and he sees this chevron-shaped craft. So it's pretty weird. And then he did note that the shadow was weird. It wasn't where it should have been, which is kind of odd. He draws in his picture where the shadow was and where it should have been in relation to the sun.
Well, you know, a lot of people will say that every single triangle craft that is being seen now is experimental military. And this is one mm-hmm. strike against that for sure. First of all, if this guy is accurate for his reporting, a translucent or a transparent or semi-transparent vehicle wouldn't make sense. And then a skewed shadow wouldn't make sense either to anything. Mm-hmm. You know, just wouldn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense anyway.
Yeah, right.
Which is just weird. So I don't know what the hell's going on with this thing.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, another interesting report. But that's essentially the news that is out there.
Yeah. Hey, I noticed an article came out. I just briefly looked at it today where China has a new radio telescope. Have you read anything about that?
Yeah. I mean, that story's been out for quite a while because they were building it, and, you know, even while they were building it, there were stories periodically that it's this gigantic antenna. Then they did sign some sort of contract even before it was finished that they were going to do SETI projects on it. So they were going to, you know, listen for radio signals and stuff like that. And now I think the it is finished.
Right.
And so there's been more stories. And then the Beyond group. So if you remember the Russian millionaire who was kind of doing these SETI projects, he, along with Stephen Hawking, is kind of on his group. I guess they have also they're the ones who have signed a contract with this antenna to use it to listen to radio signals with SETI periodically. So that kind of big antenna keeps making news on these sort of things that they're up to.
Hmm. Excellent. Well, I knew you'd know.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yep.
Hey, well, you have yourself a fine week, sir.
All right. You too.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right, everyone. Hang in there for this quick music break. We'll be right back with David Paris. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. You remembered to unmute your mic. That's great.
Yes.
welcome back to the show. Now, it was back 2 years, just over 2 years ago, I believe, when you were on before. And but since that time, we've gone live, and now we have, I don't want to say a completely new audience, but we certainly have a different audience mixed in with a lot of new people that have no idea anything about what you're doing or who you are. So if you wouldn't mind, in a nutshell, just if you would go through your background as well as what got you interested in doing the work you're doing.
Well, I guess it would have started when I was 16, when I had a sighting of a UFO up upstate New York near Goodyear Lake. And late August of 1969, so the astronauts already had landed on the moon. And I had seen this craft with some other friends at the friend's house, and we saw it come over the mountain. It was about 60 foot in diameter, about 100 feet off the top of the mountain, which was about 400 feet. So about 500 feet off the ground, a little over 1,000 feet downrange, and it was only traveling like about 20 miles an hour. And as it passed our position, it banked about 20 degrees, and you could see the entire top and the entire shape of the craft. It was a discus-shaped craft, silver metallic. And it righted up, and then it just took off. Hard to estimate how fast. I mean, it was in the hundreds of miles an hour, if not going to, you know, up to like 1,000 miles an hour. No sonic boom, no nothing. No sound, yeah. No greenhouse, nothing. The only thing I could mention is that as it passed our position, you could, when it banked, it never lost an inch of altitude.
Oh, like a plane and, does.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And being a flyer myself at that time, I was learning how to fly. Anytime you... you bank even a Piper Cub, you're losing altitude,
right.
You know?
Yeah. Did a little flying myself, so I know what you mean. Yeah.
You know, a big craft like that at 60 feet, not to lose an inch, and then to accelerate out as it did. That was one of the things that really got me interested in pursuing what I'm doing right now. Of course, it went dormant for years and years, just kind of honing all the skills needed to try to get this solution to how did that thing fly. And it was it's taken years. So since 1969, it's been on my mind, have replayed it in my mind millions of times. And now we've come to actually having a working engine, and that has been the goal all the time. And I believe that the solution that we present might be the actual mechanism that propelled that craft. In other words, creating a warp bubble and being able to adjust the fabric of space, compressing it.
Wow. Now, I one of the things that often comes up, and you just mentioned it, is certainly the silence of the craft and also possibly moving faster than the speed of sound without creating a sonic boom.
And that's correct.
Is that explained in the warp bubble?
Well, because the fabric of space is actually compressed, there really isn't any sound. I mean, the craft or the engine or, you know, whatever item you're trying to propel is surrounded by a local warp bubble. It's not visible. We've done some distortion experiments, but you have to understand that we operate on a very low power scale in comparison to potentially what that craft used. The craft was fully visible, and even when it started to accelerate, there wasn't any kind of a blurring of visibility. So it's quite a unique scenario. Our motor does not make any sound, and there's no increase in ambient air temperature within the array plates that we have. And it pulls down whatever direction you point it, it pulls itself or pulls objects to it. And we have on our website experiments and videos, documents, graphs of our results that we are willing to share. We're not willing to give the designs and all of the specifics out, but we do provide lots of diagrams, pictures, things of that nature that's on our Facebook, which we use to publish our stuff. And we have our website, Space Warp Dynamics LLC, where you can get access to the information from the Facebook as well.
Okay, so pretend I know I'm listening to this show for the first time. I have no idea what a warp bubble is. Can you explain to the listener what that is?
Sure.
Or the theory of it?
Well, we can use kind of a visual example of an accordion, for example. Stretch out the accordion, and let's consider that to be normal space. And as you then compress the bellows, you have point A to B from the accordion out to the normal space. And as you compress the bellows, now you have A and B. It's the same amount of space, it's just that it's compressed relative to the normal space. And the bubble does essentially the same thing. And what we found was quite unique is that we have made over 15 different models of the engine. And each one of these is, you know, massive improvements from one to the other to the other. Our goal is to actually make a commercial spacecraft engine. And we're approaching that quite rapidly right at this point. But to get back to the description of the local spaceport bubble, Miguel Alcubierre in 1994 came up with this idea and theory about the fabric of space being able to compress it and creating a local spaceport bubble where within the side of the bubble, if it was a spacecraft or an aircraft, which we have anecdotal evidence of, that the crew would be protected from the momentum. Hmm. And so for people, and since you guys talk lots about UFOs, I happen to be the state director for MUFON here for Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
So we investigate UFOs all the time. I mean, not to the great degree that they do on the East and West Coast. You know, we have maybe 34 cases a year. Keeps us busy, you know. But the point being is that a lot of people have observed a craft, a UFO that they have sighted, and making 90-degree turns.
Right.
Well, we know that from, unless you're flying very slow with a helicopter, you can do that, but you're still banking the chopper, okay? With an aircraft, you're not going to do that. You're going to be spamming a can if you're going, mm-hmm. you know, like Mach 3 or so. So there are limitations physically that you have in the air with aerial vehicles that humans produce. On these particular craft, the momentum, the crew is protected. So you could do, you know, turn on a dime in this regard. And the warp bubble literally protects you. You know, in the case of Bruce Gernon in 1970, when he's going from Bimini Island, he ends up at Miami Beach. You know, he got caught up into a naturally made local space warp bubble. And with that said, you know, he traveled 360,000 miles an hour in 1 second. So he traversed 100 miles, not because he wanted to. It's because the clouds formed an electric field that generated the warp bubble that was non-sustainable, but it got around his craft as he penetrated into what a lot of pilots refer to as a sucker hole. And when he went through this hole at 10,000 feet, he went rapidly through the girth of the cloud, which was about 20 plus miles. And he did it in just a few seconds. And as he got out of the cloud, ionized air surrounded his aircraft. He calls it electronic fog, but it restricted his visibility. His instruments were out. And then he ends up in Miami Beach. He makes a call to air traffic control. They said there was an aircraft at Bimini, no longer there. Now they have one over Miami Beach. And he goes, it can't be me. And so they had some arguments going back and forth. Finally, the electronic fog or the ionized air dissipated around the aircraft, and it was over Miami Beach. So he scratched his head, thought it was some kind of time travel, And, you know, I've been looking at these cases for like, you know, 14 years. And it was because of these cases that gave me the reasoning behind it was the thunderstorms with antimatter, highly energetic thunderstorms with these tripole fields, electric fields within the cloud itself. And when you pair those up with two different thunderstorms side by side, they will generate these tripole fields that cross and will create this naturally occurring phenomena of a local space warp bubble. And the compression in front of it then drives the entire system forward, in this case the aircraft. And when it dissipates, then the aircraft is popped out and left to continue to fly.
Now, this is you're not just spewing this out. I mean, there's documentation that this actually happened.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So someone can look into this. It's not, you know, it is. I remember hearing about this situation. Now, let me just ask you this. I mean, this is probably a bizarre question, but do you think that has anything to do with the Bermuda Triangle with all the mysteries of the losses of aircraft and boats and things like that?
I did forensic weather studies over 26 different aircraft incidences out of the 57. I kind of randomly picked those out and analyzed the weather forensics of what was the cause and effect, why did the aircraft go missing. And a trend began to occur, where we had like about 86% of the same similar weather conditions that these aircraft were lost. And now whether they were lost to mechanical, whether they're lost to pilot disorientation, there's been a handful of pilots from World War II to Bruce Gernon's incident that successfully transited through these tunnels and ended up, in the case of this World War II pilot, was a bi-wing aircraft called a Tiger Moth in northern England. And he was testing out the early primitive aircraft radar on his aircraft. And he got caught up in a thunderstorm, and he ended up in northern England within just a second or so. And Bruce actually had gotten a letter from his flying officer O'Brien's family, and he forwarded it to me. And I reviewed that and looked at it, and I checked out the fact that there was a radar Tiger Moth squadron stationed in northern London where they performed these experiments with the early airborne radar. So The claims that were made, seemed to be pretty much on the money. And then the testimony of the he had passed away, but his family, when they had seen a program on Discovery Channel about the Bermuda Triangle, had submitted that, and he forwarded it to me, and I analyzed it in that. Now, to answer your question about as far as the Bermuda Triangle, I believe, yes, that there's a lot of environmental thunderstorms, that rain squalls that will pop up, that will take aircraft down. A lot of VFR pilots that fly out in these regions are, classify them as weekend warriors, so to speak. Many of them don't have IFR ratings, and they get caught up into these unfamiliar type thunderstorms, and you will become disoriented and become basically trying to fly by the seat of your pants. And we all know that the fluids in your ears are not absolute balanced, and so you'll end up tipping one way or the other in the aircraft without you even knowing it, and you'll spiral down into the ocean. Mm. So these are problems of pilot disorientation when they get caught up into these unusual circumstances. Thunderstorms can erupt very vigorously, within less than 15 minutes. And in the Bermuda, whether it's a triangle, a square, a circle, it's an area where you have a lot of light variable winds aloft, and you have tremendous amounts of water vapor into the area. And it doesn't take much at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon to spawn thunderstorms very violently. and they will form around warm water pools where there's actually eddies and currents within the ocean that have warmer water than other surrounding areas by a degree or so. And these thunderstorms can just erupt. And in Bruce's case, formed a ring around his aircraft, and he had only a limited amount of fuel on board the craft because from West Palm Beach to Andros Island, where he had actually landed, there was no facilities there. It was just a grass strip. So when he took off at 3 in the afternoon, he had witness that showed him taking off. And the typical trip takes 75 minutes, and he would have gone about 210 miles on the average. At the conclusion of this trip, because he was avoiding thunderstorms and changing his flight path, he actually traveled 250 miles. But that 75-minute trip turned into 47 minutes, and he landed in West Palm Beach at 3:47. And so his aircraft clock was in synchronous with the ground clock. So we know it's not time travel. And the thing that, after reading his accounts of the kind of hydroplaning of the aircraft, the feeling of some feeling of weightlessness in the aircraft momentarily, I started to do some additional research, and I discovered Alcubierre's theories about warp bubbles and got more involved into it, and basically took the concepts of what the thunderstorms were doing in their tripole fields generations, and which is basically a dipole and an inverted dipole. So you got plus, minus, minus at the freezing level, and then plus at the bottom. And so, and this was discovered by a man named by the name of Earl Wilson in 1984. He was a very big proponent of the internal electrical patterns within thunderstorms. And of course, you know, when he came out with these things, everybody kind of poo-pooed him until more recently. You know, they had a different theory of how the electric fields actually were oriented inside these thunderstorms. So what I did was I took that information about the tripole fields, the natural occurring tripole fields, and I brought it into the lab. Since I had done a lot of flying down in that region and had a lot of instrumentation with me, I had a lot of my own personal measurements when I did a lot of these programs for Discovery and History and TLC and Nat Geo. So I took advantage of the aircraft flights and loaded up all my equipment in there and then gathered a bunch of the information. So I brought it back into the lab, and my idea was to replicate. If this actually occurs, then I should be able to replicate this in the lab. And that's where the idea came from to start to pursue actually building the engine that we have today. Now, the antennas that we built were tripole antennas. Especially, you don't buy these things. You have to build everything. And it was a unique design that I had come up with. And we had parts of an old optic table railings, and we had an interferometer that we had built from scratch. And back in 2012, when we brought this into the lab, we had the Thiales. The French came over. And it was the first time anything had ever been filmed, and it was the first time we were turning on the experiment. And we had video cameras set up on screens and things, and we noticed that the laser light that caused these fringe patterns on our projection screen, when we activated the system, they actually, instead of blooming out, they bloomed in. So in other words, we were seeing compression into these fringe patterns. And they asked me, so, well, is this significant? And I go, well, I'm not going to make that statement today until we do further research with this. But it looks like something is happening here. It looks like we're getting a laser to compress in the fringe patterns that's being produced. Well, letter analysis showed we had spent about 6-7 months doing all these experiments to validate what was actually going on with the laser and the interferometer. And we came up with all different kinds of approaches on this because we're more skeptical than the skeptics are, you know. If this didn't work, if this actually didn't have all the criteria that actually shows that the fabric of space can be artificially compressed, would have abandoned the project a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had, you know, it's been a maturing, you know, there's been a growth in the concepts. You know, we discovered a redshift into our one of our original engines, and we took that measurement. And then later on, we set up a case that had glass and wood and suspended a torsion bar with ferrous on one experiment and non-ferrous material on another. And we were 140 centimeters from the engine, and we mounted it in a vertical array and concentrated onto one side of the torsion bar, perfectly balanced with a monofilament line, and we pulled that material. And that day, a TV station local came in and actually videotaped the movement of the masses being pulled by 25 watts of power, 100 watts of power, which also showed us is that the fabric of space can actually go through objects.
Wow.
So where a lot of other people are looking at, you know, the concept of gravity, gravity gradients and all this, you know, Einstein provided provisions for the in a relativity of looking at things due to mass and basically changing the fabric of space. So the bigger the mass, the more change in the fabric of space around that object.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at our sun, you look at our planetary systems and how we kind of look like a big pizza pie, you know, very flat, essentially. And we kind of always spiral down towards the sun, but only because the fabric of space has been altered around the sun because of its mass, particularly around the equator where it has kind of a bulge. And as a result of that kind of spiraling down, we just have enough momentum to keep us in orbit up and around the object. And if you go to a black hole, you're going to see the same type of thing, you know, near the outer areas of the black hole where you're going to start to see compression of the fabric of space because of the incredible mass that a black hole can generate
mm-hmm.
as a result of absorbing other materials around it. So we know that all of this fabric of space alteration is possible. And the discovery of antimatter in thunderstorms, there were papers written in 2007, the beginning the investigation of the possibility. 2010 with the cluster spacecraft and the themes spacecraft started to give us some ideas about that, hey, there's something going on in these thunderstorms. Papers were written in 2010. And then finally, the Fermi spacecraft begins to receive gamma rays back from the Earth on the backside of the Fermi spacecraft. And it was designed to look out into space to survey and try to find clusters or areas that still had antimatter in it. And they did find some, you know, around Jupiter, and they found some out into deep space. But if they would have turned the whole thing around, they would have discovered that the Earth generates trillions of these antimatters right inside the clouds. So these positrons are generated as a result of all this intense energy that's generated in these clouds. And they kind of give you an idea, you know, you're looking at 10 to the 7th or 13 kiloton atomic bomb, watts of power, 10 to the 7th watts of power. And these thunderstorms generate, particularly into the 10 degrees, 20 degrees north latitude, these things generate like 10 to the 15th watts of power. So, you know, that's 10 to the 8th difference. Okay. So, I mean, you know, you're talking into the tens of millions of differences here in the energy that's generated by these things that's resonant there for as long as the thunderstorm's up and running. And so as a result, Bruce Gernon, Arthur Godfrey, Flying Officer O'Brien, we have another case study, Lieutenant Frank Lieutenant Colonel Frank Hopkins. All these different cases, and a lot of people will say, oh, well, they're all anecdotal. Great. But they all had similar experiences. The descriptions are almost identical. And so as a result, if you can, if they're claiming this, you should be able to reproduce it. And we did. So that was the big the deal that we were able to uncover, that there's a natural phenomena out there and we can replicate it in the lab. Now, our other big problem was, well, how do you actually implement something like this? You know, my first idea was, well, what if we set up these two huge radio towers and put, like, you know, millions of watts of energy through mm-hmm. each one of these things and then fly an airplane between it? Well, you're only going to get a very temporary, non-sustainable warp bubble, if that, okay? And how far would the aircraft go? 100 miles, 50 miles, 2 miles? So the real problem started to exist is that even though we could demonstrate a redshift, which represents a compaction of the fabric of space, the movement of ferrous and non-ferrous material, no sound, no increase in ambient air temperature. I mean, all of these things that are going on, that the idea of building an engine to try to artificially induce this was then the next key in the ultimate design of what we have right now. And I chose to use fractals. We call these our fractal arrays, and we replicate a tripole field, and we have multiple tripole fields on our each side of the engine, and they're angled, and it can be variable. And I designed it so that we could test all types of possibilities: spacing of the fractal pads, the angles of the arrays as they open and close. And I can't tell you how many thousands of these adjustments that we've made. And we're trying to look for the most optimum configuration possible to get the maximum amount of a pull, the pulling force, or the compression of the fabric of space with the least amount of energy. And so, again, we have 15 different models, and we're working with model 15A right now. But in comparison to some of our previous models, Model 13 in particular, what we accomplished at 1 Newton for 500 watts, or 1 Newton at 1,000 watts, I should say, is that we now get 1 Newton of pull at 500 watts, and we get 2 Newtons at 1,000 watts. And you would say, well, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. That's, you know, basically 2 newtons is equivalent to 7.5 ounces of potential pull or weight. Well, you put this into space and you make a comparison against the Dawn spacecraft, which is a 99 millinewton spacecraft for ion drive engine that has to have fuel, you know, xenon fuel. And they can achieve, and this is the project, like Project Horizon that went to Pluto, this thing will travel 26,700 miles an hour. It took nearly 4 years for that to build up to that speed. And using their same specific impulse criteria that they used on the calculations for that engine, we put in ours. And at 2 newtons of force in 4 years, because ours is an accumulative process, we would achieve 91 million miles per hour. I know as soon as somebody hears that, they flip out and they go, yeah, you can't do that. Okay. We've done the experiments. Okay. We've provided the data. There have been people that constantly email us for the specifications and the design. Hey, we're a private company, okay? We're a for-profit, but we haven't produced anything to sell yet. But I've been paying for the whole thing, you know. It's self-funded. And I work five jobs. I teach college, and I'm an adjunct. And I teach science, astronomy, meteorology, physics. I have 10 different courses that I teach. And at any given semester, I'm teaching about 7 different courses at 4 other colleges. And my fifth job is space warp dynamics. So,
wow.
It's if I'm not teaching, I'm out in the lab. I'm extremely dedicated to this, and so is my team. No one gets paid, and we've been together for well over 4 years.
Wow, that's saying something. Just a couple things I wanted to mention here. First of all, we do have, for the listener, we do have the forum open now that anyone can join, and there is a number of questions on the forum. I think you sort of covered a couple already of those questions. Also, there's questions on the message board coming in. But you are... you have the distinguished honor of being my number one download of shows, tens of thousands of downloads. And the question I have for you about that is, why do you think that is? Is it people that are looking for other things other than UFOs that came to listen to that show? I'm talking about the previous show, and hopefully this one will be well downloaded as well.
Sure. I mean, on our Facebook, we have almost 1,900 people that are associated to the Facebook, and they are very hungry for anything and everything. Now, as I said, we use that to post our results that we share. We don't give away the whole thing, but, you know, we do produce the graphs and that power comparisons between the different motor types that we've developed. And pictures of the lab and pictures of the devices that we have and all that type of thing. And to answer your question, I think people are interested because this is literally the wave of the future. And whether it's us getting into the marketplace first, second, third, or whatever, it's that we are bound to get this off the ground at some point. And hopefully starting in space, getting an opportunity to actually go to space to deploy the engine. The fact that we actually operate this engine on battery. So we are not plugged into the wall, but we actually have designed everything to facilitate battery power from a spacecraft. And we actually use battery pack that I designed, and you can see it into some of the pictures that we put out there. It's all rechargeable and everything, but the entire system works off a battery, and we have throttles. It's a real engine, you know. And what we've discovered is, well, let me answer the rest of the question that you asked. Why do people are interested? Because I think science fiction has created a overwhelming introduction to the possibilities of what space could, you know, provide to the human race. And it was bound to happen at some point. For me, it was seeing a spacecraft or an unidentified flying object, and that stimulated my interest in trying to figure out what made that damn thing fly. And I, like I mentioned before, I think I have succeeded in that. However, people are interested because of the possibilities of going to the asteroid belt, going to the moon. I mean, let's face it, you know, in 40 years, we really haven't done much in space other than orbit around. We have the International Space Station, but there's only 7 people that can be on there any given time. And there's huge restrictions of the imagination, you know, people actually going to space. I think, what do we have, like 600 to 700 astronauts over the course of the last 40 years that have actually gone into space, but only 12 that have landed on the moon? Hey, I think people are hungry. And if they see something that has perspective, a prospect of being successful, I think that they're going to listen, they're going to look. And of course, you have skeptics. There's that site that you had given to me on the email of a link to the skeptic physicist and stuff. Well, you know, when you read that and you look at what they do, they don't touch any of the things that we've already investigated. I have two physicists on my staff, okay? Both of them work with cyclotrons, linear accelerators. My partner, the vice president of the company, is going to be getting his PhD here in just the next 2 years. And he's working at the Fermi Lab right now.
Hmm.
And the other physicist is in cryogenics. And he just moved from Idaho, where he was building a linear accelerator, and had this other opportunity down in San Francisco. So we've got guys in New York. We've got guys in Illinois. We've got a couple of guys in California, and we have local. And because of Skype, because of cell phone, because of email, we communicate. And it's almost like everybody's here. And when they pass through town, they stop in and look at the lab, and, you know, we work out some additional experiments, things of that nature. So the fact that not everybody is physically here, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, because if they weren't intrigued by the results, if they weren't intrigued by what we're doing, what we're striving to do, they would have been gone a long time ago.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you mentioned earlier, you know, 12 people on the moon, it was 1969. It really does seem like a major stagnation. I mean, if you think about it, 1969, we actually went and landed on the moon, and I truly believe we did. I'm not one of the conspirators that say we didn't. But, I believe we actually landed on the moon, and it just seems like we should be a lot further along. If you ask someone back in 1969, well, we're on the moon, what do you think we're going to do in 10 years? They'd say Mars. You know, I mean, that type of thing. And it does seem pretty strange that we haven't. I know a lot of it has to do with, of course, funding and the restrictions and the cutbacks and all that. But interesting.
Well, I can tell you is that we've operated on a shoestring budget. You know, like, again, I fund just about the majority of everything that goes on here. And we've got well over $80,000 invested into this technology. And if you were to go to a lab, which the skeptic physicist cite there, because we're not MIT, because we're not Caltech, we're not an aerospace company, that obviously we're not we're just a bunch of BSers, you know. But and by the fact, we work out of a garage, okay. But let me also cite that Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Wright Brothers, Glenn Curtis, Robert Goddard, P.T. Farnsworth, all these guys that – and P.T. Farnsworth, the guy who developed television, they worked out of garages in apartments. And the list goes on of these early developments, because they were tenacious. They had an idea. And if they actually listened to anybody around them that, hey, what you're doing is impossible, you know, we'd still be, you know, cooking meat over a fire, you know, in a bunch of caves.
Yeah, there's a good saying that goes with that. If you think you can, you might. If you think you can't, you're right. And, you know, I mean, if you just stay persistent and you obviously have a real passion for this, and then your enthusiasm has attracted other people to you. And someone asked earlier on the message board, why hasn't NASA, you know, jumped on board with, you know, pulled you into their mix? Or have you ever been approached by anyone with funding and turned it away, or that?
Yes.
Okay. Let's hear about that.
Okay. After that article came out from the World Herald, it was simply thousands of emails that came through, and lots of venture capitalists and people that wanted to get in bed with this project. And I didn't take anybody up on their offers. We're being watched by government agencies and stuff. I've gotten emails from the government. And at this juncture, we're not going to patent the engine, because of the little known unknown codicil in the 1950s that Congress passed that if you have a patent, the government can come in and stop what you're doing and take it. So
doesn't that make you nervous not to have that protection also as far as someone stealing your ideas?
Well, that's why we don't put out everything. And the times that we tried to get involved with, like, the future of space travel propulsion systems and a number of different congresses of those types of meetings, and we've prepared the documents and sent them in and stuff, everything's always been rejected. Or we've been told, you're a little bit premature on your claims, and why don't you publish some more, and we'll get back to you in a couple of years. And it's like, hey, you know what? I don't really care. If you don't want the materials, fine. Then we work alone, and that's the way of it. Now, as far as NASA's concerned, they know we exist, and I've been told by several people who know and then work with NASA and Eagle Works and all those types, they know who we are. But it's not invented here kind of stuff. You know, they're into the EM drive, which was an engineer out of England. And he was the Shire motor in 2001. And for 15 years, they belittled this guy and claimed that they couldn't figure out why the thing thrusted. And it's essentially a microwave-driven element inside of a chamber. And recently, the Eagle Works guys, Dr. Sonny White and some of the others, are publishing a paper where they have made the claim that they've seen or measured a warp bubble within the chamber. Now, they're a thrusting engine. We're a pulling engine. We actually compress the fabric of space into the vanes of the motor, the panels. I encourage people that are curious about what the motor looks like is to go to the website, go to the Facebook, and look at the pictures, because it's laid out there. I'm holding it's over 2 foot in length. It's 6 inches in girth. It's got two panels, and you'll see the fractal tripole fields in there. I'm holding it. And so you can see that picture to get kind of an idea about, like, where we've been and where, you know, we're headed. But to that regard, it's very political. And funding is tight. And so as a very good friend of mine, Dr. Kasher, had stated in the paper, NASA is not going to fund him. He's going to have to do this totally on his own. And when it's successful, then people may look, but ultimately it's going to be all on his back to make this thing up and out of the lab and into an opportunity to go to space. I have been contacted by Aerospace Company, and I've been waiting to we're working on this new data measurement system that actually measures the output of the engine, and we take it in layers, 6 inches from the bottom of the motor, and we go 1 inch in to the bottom of the motor, and we take over 500 different points, and we're meshing them all together to create a three-dimensional pull of the motor, a visible image. And this has taken inordinate amounts of time to collect this data. You can see that again on Facebook, some of the instrumentation that we've adapted. You don't go down the store to the local convenient mart and try to buy some of this equipment. Everything is custom made, and that's what we've done. And it's been a real team effort here.
So, is the reason, or you can just say what the reason is, but is the reason you've turned away funding is because you think you may lose some control, or is there a possibility? It sounds to me like there's a possibility of a major payday if you can actually get this thing, completely in the works.
There will be a large payday when you consider the possibilities. Space is just one part of the payday, but the amount of energy needed to get off the ground of thousands of pounds is really not that much. Now, we have the capacity to go up to 4,500 watts. Most of our tests are below 1,000 watts of power because we generate our prediction charts and whatnot from that. The reason why I hold back on just going full bore is that, you know, these units that we constructed are close to $10,000 a piece. Hmm. I can't afford to have these things for whatever, you know, a mishap of something. I can't replace them at this point. So we're testing at low power. Eventually, we will, within the next, by summertime, we'll start to hook up all the remaining power sources that we need, and they all operate on battery. And we will then go for our other tests. But we want to bring in, we want to team up with a company that would indirectly protect us. Because if you're big enough and you got enough cash, it doesn't make any difference what the government wants or what somebody else wants. The power of the lawsuit, the power of the lawyer is big, and you got to have the cash to do it. We don't.
Why does Elon Musk come to mind?
Well, Elon Musk, you know, would be perhaps perfectly suited to come in here and to look. However, you know, when he gets something in his hands, he opens it up to the public, and I'm not willing to do that. Uh-huh. I've spent too much time and effort on this project to just do an open source so everybody and their uncle can go build warp drive engines. So if it sounds selfish on my part, too bad.
Yeah, well.
I'm a capitalist, okay? I believe in capitalism. I have spent lots of money and lots of my time, and when this comes out of the lab and initially goes to space, I'd like to see some remuneration for the work. Non-reoccurring engineering costs, as a lot of people would say. But now, the potential of these things into the billions and trillions of dollars of affecting terrestrial and space transportation.
All right. That's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to support the show and hear the whole show plus archives in your media player or on the website, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com and you can pay as little as $2 a month. And don't forget to check out the forum. You can join the forum if you would like to talk about a UFO sighting or interact with other people. And that's right on our website as well. So next week, we have Christopher O'Brien, our repeat guest, is going to be back. And we have a number of great guests lined up in the future. Thanks so much again for listening. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.